Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our fall membership drive, and we're about that in just a minute. But first, you know I love a good cookbook, and the new cookbook by Christopher Kimball is more, very much more than merely good. It's a product of a new approach to cooking that Kimball has taken in his work with Milk Street in downtown Boston, home to his cooking school, a bi-monthly magazine, and a public television and radio show. Kimball is a familiar face and voice to public media audiences. He founded Cooks Magazine in 1980, relaunched it as Cooks Illustrated in 1993, and founded Cooks Country Magazine in 2004. He was host and executive producer of America's Test Kitchen and Cooks Country, the two highest-rated cooking shows on television. He also hosted America's Test Kitchen on public radio. He is the author of several books, and he joins us now. A very special welcome to Christopher Kimball. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio will be coming to 89.7 NPR News starting Saturday, October 7th. Tell us about the show. What's the format?
We're talking about the radio show or
the
television show?
The radio show.
Yeah, the radio show. Yeah. Well, radio is, as you know, very different than television. And it allows us, obviously, to travel all over the world in a way that we cannot do as easily on television. It also allows us to get into a whole variety of topics where, you know, food's an entry point for almost anything. And so we can talk to a Buddhist nun in South Korea who's also a cook, or talk to Syrian refugees about their experience and their food. We can go to South Africa to go to a barbecue place in the Guguletu Township. So it's actually more fun and more interesting than doing television. We do call-ins, of course, and mm-hmm. we have regular contributors to the show. But we get to interview people from around the world and talk about almost anything. And so I really love the radio show.
The book is absolutely beautiful. The subtitle is The New Home Cooking. What do you mean by that?
Well, all my life I've cooked American food, which is primarily, at least in New England, Northern European food. That made a lot of sense for a long time. But it turns out, as everyone knows, the rest of the world thinks very differently about food and cooking. And what they do in general is to start with very powerful ingredients. You know, Northern Europe used almost no spices, almost no herbs. You know, French cooking is a sprig of thyme, right? Two bay leaves. Chilies, fermented sauces, soy sauce, fish sauce, lemongrass, ginger, you know, all these other things. And so when you start with very powerful flavors, you can get to a dish with strong flavors very quickly and easily. If you start with Northern European ingredients, which tend to be very mild, and so you need a lot of technique and a lot of time to transform them into sort of this perfect melting pot. But the rest of the world doesn't do melting pot. You know, if you taste the tagine, you can taste the ginger, and you can taste the turmeric, you can taste the chicken, you can taste the potatoes, etc. You can taste the cumin, you can taste all those different flavors. And so the new home cooking is about going around the world, cooking with a bunch of home cooks, coming back and figuring out how to change our cooking here to really suit the 21st century, which I don't think is Northern European cooking traditionally just not right for how we cook now.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. This is our fall membership drive. Listener support is the foundation of our budget. Please make your gift right now at WOSU.org or by calling 1-866-897-9678. For a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer, we'll send you Christopher Kimball's book, Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. This absolutely beautiful book is brand new, more than 340 pages. For more than 25 years, Christopher Kimball has promised home cooks that his recipes would work. Now, with his team of cooks and editors at Milk Street, he promises a new approach in the kitchen that can elevate the quality of your cooking. Get this great book for $10 a month as a sustainer or a one-time gift of $120. You'll be supporting public radio and get this wonderful, useful book as your thank you gift. Visit WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. Again, the number's 1-866-897-9678. If you would like to speak with Christopher Kimball, you have a question or comment for him, you can give us a call too. That number is 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Christopher Kimball, how did you get into the cooking business?
Oh, I've always cooked since I was 8 or 9 years old. I got into it in the late 70s, 1979. I founded Cook's Magazine in 1980 because nobody was talking about cooking. Although, you know, Cuisine Magazine, Food and Wine, et cetera, everyone was talking about the lifestyle of food and travel and restaurants. But nobody was talking about the guts of it, you know, getting in the kitchen and how to hold a knife. And so I needed to learn how to do those things, and I started a magazine to really teach myself how to cook.
Okay. Tell us about Milk Street in Boston. Your staff is small but mighty.
Yeah, we have about 25 people here. We're at 177 Milk Street. It's the old Grain Exchange building right down across from the aquarium in Boston, downtown Boston. Used to be the old Custom House, actually, originally. A fabulous old building. They wrap it with a bow at Christmas time, which I refer to as a bow tie, so I knew it was the perfect place for me.
Exactly.
But, I mean, it's huge ceilings. We have access from the street, so we have cooking classes in the evenings, 3 nights a week. Just a great place. And, you know, what's interesting is the food is so much different than what I'm used to doing. It's just really exciting because the rest of the world not only uses different ingredients sometimes, but they think about food differently. They think about supper differently, or what is dinner. It's not just a question of cooking technique or the recipe. It's just thinking about cooking in a totally different way. And that's, for me, you know, an old dog, you know, these really are new tricks. It's really exciting.
They came up in lots of different recipes and lots of different ways. In the soup section, you write that, as with many cuisines, you try to treat meat as a seasoning rather than the main event.
That's so true. And, I mean, just take a typical beef stew, right? You have 2 or 3 pounds of meat. You cut it into 2-inch chunks. You saute it, you know, in 2 or 3 batches. Well, do you ever think about it? I mean, and then you put beef stock in it.
Right.
Well, that's a umami bomb. I mean, why would you? You don't need to saute meat. Almost nobody in other cultures sautés meat because you want to let the other flavors come through. And you don't use 3 pounds of meat. You might use a pound of meat for 6 or 8 people because meat's just one part of the picture. And so then you understand that it's about balance. You have sweet, sour, salty, you know, creamy, crunchy, bitter. You know, bitter and charred are flavors that you don't see in American cooking as much. Or for example, in a spicy dish like peri peri chicken from South Africa, they use sweetness to balance the heat. And so sweet and heat go together. As a matter of fact, if you have a chili that's too hot, if you add just a little bit of sugar, it will cut down the heat. And so that balance and adding different things instead of just having, you know, beef stock and 3 pounds of sautéed meat, you can make a wonderful super stew, but there's more balance. There are other things going on.
It's a clue to me when we talk about food that way that why in other cultures there's not the obesity problems that we have in the United States and that kind of a thing too. The balance.
Well, if you think, you know, every place in the world develops a cuisine that makes sense for that place. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not a brilliant statement. But Northern Europe had a ton of meat, right? I mean, meat was cheap. They had a ton of fuel. They had wood and they had coal. And so they cooked things for a long time, and they used a lot of meat. So and a lot of obviously wheat. Other places in the world, meat was very expensive. You know, they had goat, they had lamb, but they didn't have, you know, tons of beef, and they didn't have a lot of fuel. That's why the wok is so brilliant, right? Very small amount of fuel, heat things up very quickly, cook things in small pieces in 5 or 10 minutes. So people adapted to what they had. I was in the Sahara Desert years ago, walking, oddly enough. And I found these little ovens that were just peppering the landscape, very small, flat ovens. And so if a Berber was, you know, coming through, they would just use that oven to do flatbreads. But it was a very small oven, so it was very fuel efficient. So everyone solves the problem of cooking food in their location with a different solution based on where they are.
Thanks to Isaac Kershaw and Wes Jefferson and David Naldolny in Worthington for your support. Christopher Kimball is our guest this hour, and we're offering his new book as a thank you gift. This thank you gift is an extension of the conversation we're having today. If you enjoy listening to All Sides, but if you especially enjoy shows we do about cooking, then this is a great time to become a member. For $10 a month as a sustainer, you get the book Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Visit WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. This book includes beautiful, colorful photographs and has sections about the pantry, soups, vegetables, dinners, breads, and more. The pantry section focuses on the essential items for the Milk Street pantry that will add lots of flavor to your cooking and make things very convenient when you're working with the book. Become a member of 89.7 NPR News and get this great book as our way of saying thank you. That's $10 a month as a sustainer. WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. You know, we've been talking about how the rest of the world looks at and thinks about food differently than we do here in the United States. Take the new spin on breakfast with curry braised eggs to fresh takes on classic desserts with rosemary, pine nut, cornmeal cookies. This book has it all. Make a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer and get this great new book. Go to WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. And thanks to Jerry Holt and Worthington for your support as well. You start the book, as I mentioned earlier, with the pantry section, and that kicks off with butter, apropos, I guess. It's alphabetical, I believe, but you point out that you're breaking with tradition when you recommend salted butter, and I was surprised to see that. So explain why the break on that score.
Well, butter doesn't last very long in the fridge. It picks up flavors quickly. It goes bad. I mean, it was so funny. I grew up in a household where the butter was left on the countertop, you know, at all the time.
Yeah.
And so I grew up with rancid butter. I thought that's how it was supposed to taste. And then I started eating real, you know, fresh butter. Oh, this is really good. So so salted butter keeps longer. Salted butter, you should never put unsalted butter on bread. It was just terrible.
Uh-huh.
And actually, if you saute foods with butter or butter and oil, salted butter, actually, oddly enough, you get better flavor in it, as opposed to using unsalted butter and then salt. And so we just use it for everything. And it's 1/8 of a teaspoon of salt per stick of butter. That's what salted butter is. So there really isn't that much salt in it, but it does preserve it. And I know if a stick of butter sits there for 2 or 3 weeks in the fridge unsalted butter, it's going to be pretty awful after about a week or 10
mm-hmm.
days.
I keep mine in the freezer.
That's a good place for it. But the problem with the freezer is if you need softened
right.
butter, you know, it's, you got to go through the 10% microwave thing.
Exactly.
Know.
The only thing it's really good for is the crust issue. And you've made the point in the pantry section when it comes to the butter that just make sure whatever your recipe you're using, if you are going to use unsalted butter, or I'm sorry, if you're going to use salted butter, to make the change in the salt, added salt.
But there isn't that much salt in it anyway. It's not going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And also, you know, people always ask me, you know, what are three things people should do at home differently in cooking? And one of them is to add more salt. It's very weird. 5% of our sodium intake comes from home cooking. It all comes from
processed
foods prepared at restaurants or processed foods, right? They're full of salt. So the amount of salt you consume when you cook at home is de minimis anyway. And this whole thing about salt and high blood pressure, et cetera, I mean, if you have a real serious medical condition, obviously you need to listen to your doctor. But otherwise, you know, salt's good for you, and it's an important part of the diet. So you use more salt, you'll have better food. I know so many times when I cook, for example, with my wife's parents, you know, inevitably, if you taste it, all you do is add some more salt, and it tastes 10 times better. You know? So they think I'm a genius. All I did was secretly add a little salt when they weren't looking. You know, it's like,
right.
Anyway.
I
shouldn't have said that publicly. That was my secret.
Well, you know, I grew up in I didn't grow up in a house where we left the butter out, but I did grow up in a house. And for that, I was very thankful when the butter spreads came out. But I did grow up in a house where salt and pepper was on the table. And I never put salt and pepper out on the table anymore, but I certainly added it to my cooking.
Well, that's another thing. I mean, have you ever thought, if you think about salt and pepper, really think about it.
Yeah.
You go, this like makes no sense. Because salt is a unique ingredient, enhances flavor for a whole variety of reasons. Pepper is just a spice.
Yeah.
You know, there are dozens of spices. So in the Middle East, they use salt and cumin,
yeah.
right? I mean, they don't use pepper. I mean, so pepper was a very expensive trade ingredient with Southeast Asia, the islands, back in the 1860s, 70s, and 80s. And so it became this commodity, which Northern Europe got their hands on. But there's no reason to use pepper as sort of this ubiquitous generic ingredient that always goes with salt. You know, salt and pepper need a divorce. I mean, just they really need to go their own way.
I think it's really interesting how it evolved that way, though, don't you?
Well, if you think about Northern Europe, I mean, how many spices did they use? Think about French cooking. I mean, what about Mastering the Art of French Cooking? How many spices did Julie have in that book? None.
Right.
I mean, and now some people probably jokingly say, well, spices don't really go with wine. That would be one reason. But it's because they didn't really have that many spices. You know, Istanbul, you know, was on the spice route. So the Sultan, you know, with all his chefs, would have 80 or 90 spices available to him. And if you go from, I just interviewed an author who once trekked from Poland to Turkey in the early 90s. And he said, you know, the food went from, you know, good food, but on the bland side, to getting it into the Middle East and Turkey, to all of a sudden this entirely different set of flavors. And so Northern Europe, I'm not getting down on Northern Europe. There's a lot of wonderful food there, but other places in the world have a lot more tools at their disposal when it comes to spices and chilies and handfuls of herbs. I mean, in Georgia, for example, you know, if you made a stew, you throw in two or three handfuls of herbs at the end. None of this quarter teaspoon or this sprig, you know, it's massive quantities. And Otto Lengi, Yotam Otto Lengi, you know, came out with his books, Jerusalem Plenty, et cetera. Yeah, I have to give him credit. He was really the first person to introduce many of us to the idea of a handful of anything. In Palestine, in the Middle East, they make a chicken dish, sumac chicken, where they actually use 3 tablespoons of sumac, which is this red berry, which was sort of the equivalent of lemon in the Middle East. And, you know, 3 tablespoons. I grew up using a quarter teaspoon, right, of cumin. I mean, no, they use massive quantities. It's a whole different way of thinking about flavor.
Thanks to Michael Scherfe in Mount Vernon and also Letitia King in Reynoldsburg for your support today. If you want to show your support for 89.7 NPR News, give us a call at 1-866-897-9678. We have Real Life Central Ohioans standing by to take your call. This is how they show their support for 89.7 NPR News. You can show your support by giving what you can in support of your local public radio station. You can also go to WOSU.org and make your pledge there. My guest this hour is Christopher Kimball. He is very familiar voice to public media audiences. He founded Cook's Magazine in 1980, relaunched it as Cook's Illustrated in 1993, founded Cook's Country Magazine in 2004. He was host and executive producer of America's Test Kitchen and Cook's Country, the two highest rated cooking shows on television, also hosted America's Test Kitchen on public radio. Now he has a new program on public radio. He joins 89.7 NPR News on October 7th, Saturday, October 7th. Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio will be coming to the airwaves. And I know you're going to enjoy that. I know there are a lot of cooks out there. I do my fair share of cooking shows, as you know. And I'm surprised that so few people have called in so far to ask Christopher a question. Maybe you're a little starstruck. That's okay. Give us a call. He's a font of information and ready, willing, and able to take your calls. That number is 614-292-8513. Again, 292-8513. There's just so many things in the book I want to talk about, Christopher. I won't have time, but when you talked about cooking spray, you mentioned baking spray, and I had not heard of that. I really mostly just bake pies, but what's the difference between baking spray and cooking spray?
It just has flour in it.
So it's aerosol?
When you spray, okay. It's aerosol. Uh-huh. You know, it's like a typical spray under pressure with aerosol, but it's flour as well. And so, it actually works very well. I mean, if you just want to go that route. I mean, if you have a bun pan, though, you want to make sure that that's extremely well greased. And also, we found that bun pans, over time, do tend to lose their nonstick finish. So, if you're having trouble with a bun pan, you need to go out and buy a new one probably. But softened butter or even melted butter with a pastry brush will do a great job as well.
In the book, you define what is and what is not a recipe. You wrote that it has roots. What do you mean by that? Tell us about your thoughts about what a recipe means.
I think first of all, let me back up. We're not interested in in authentic recipes from another culture. I don't think you really can take a dish like thiboudienne, which is a rice dish from Senegal with fish. The way it's made, the way it's served, the whole culture around it is particular to that part of the world. So you really can't authentically reproduce it somewhere else. So I'm not a big fan of that. I think you can be inspired and you can learn lessons and bring them back. But ultimately, a real recipe, I think, it does have a context, right? It comes from somewhere. It comes from a tradition. It comes from a need. You know, people didn't have a lot of this, they used that, or they didn't have a lot of fuel, so they did a stir fry. So there's always a reason behind a recipe and a place and a point of origin. And I think it makes a recipe vastly more interesting and more enjoyable if you know where it came from. So in Mill Street, we always like to talk about where something comes from and actually get on a plane and go there as much as we can. And we're not going to authentically bring it back, but we will try to understand the spirit of the recipe, what people are after, and then adapt it to what we do here. But just a made-up recipe with no history to it is fine, but I'd vastly prefer a recipe that actually comes from a place and a time.
What's the process of adapting it? I suppose it depends on the recipe, but can you give us an example of how that happens?
Sure. They're the obvious things. The cooking tools are different. Some of the ingredients are hard to find, so we would tend to stay away from that. I mean, we do have ingredients that you're going to have to go look for, like sumac, for example, or pomegranate molasses and things. I mean, I think people can get almost anything these days, especially mm-hmm. online. So we're less concerned about that than we were. But what it really comes down to is a taste profile, for example. We just did a Haitian pumpkin soup. We were up in Montreal and cooking with some folks up there. Well, what they like about the soup, it's very thick. It's almost a pureed soup. And we liked it as a much thinner, brothy soup. So we felt that for our palates here, we wanted a different style. So we might just decide for the American home cook, this is preferable. We might decide to simplify a recipe, for example, because we can get most of what the recipe was after with half the ingredients. So we might do that. So we make a recipe. We taste it. A bunch of us taste it. We make comments. We go back into the kitchen. I'm used to, in my prior life, testing a recipe 30, 40, 50 times. We do not do that anymore. We spend a lot of time on the front end talking about what we're after, and we want to get through a recipe in many fewer tests than that, because we just don't think we're going to end up with a better recipe on the 39th try. So we can get through a recipe definitely under 10 tests. Because we're very careful about what we're testing and trying to focus on what's really important.
Christopher Kimball, once again, is our guest this hour. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our fall membership drive, and listener support is the foundation of our budget. During this show, you hear conversations with interesting people, and those conversations are in-depth. Many times we talk to a guest for an entire hour, like this hour with Christopher Kimball, one of the most famous cooks in the world. His cookbooks have been around the world. Now his cookbooks includes recipes from around the world, or at least adaptations of those recipes. You hear experts in the studio like him. We bring you a show that is truly local. You only find that on public radio. Support the station you depend on at WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. Contribute at $10 a month as a sustainer and get the book Milk Street. This book includes recipes for inspired vegetable dishes and simple, delicious suppers. Learn how to make Indian tomato rice and Cuban-style pork with mojo sauce and much more, mojo sauce and much more. This book also includes a chapter on staples, sauces, and seasonings. Learn how to make a spicy peanut sauce and green goddess tofu dressing. And then the book provides ideas for ways to use the sauces and dressings. Get this brand new book right now. Make a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer or a one-time gift of $120 at WOSU.org or call 1-866-888-8888. 877-867-9678. Again, go online to WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. Thanks to Robert Pettigrew in Columbus and Jane and Bob Hutchison in Columbus for your support. 1-866-897-9678 is the number to call. Tim in Dublin, you're on the air with Christopher Kimball. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Chris. Hi, Dan. How are you?
Fine.
Good. How are you?
Great. Chris, I like to bake, and I know European recipes weigh the ingredients rather than just use volume. What's your opinion of that?
Here in Milk Street, we've absolutely gone over to the European method of weighing ingredients by grams, and it's much better. If you took a cup of all-purpose flour and measured it by volume, you could get 20-30% difference depending on who's doing the measuring. So we absolutely believe in weights by gram. In fact, in the September-October issue of Milk Street, we actually did a chart, which is how many grams a cup of different flour weighs. We did about 10 different flours. So absolutely, absolutely weigh your flour.
Have you recommended a good kitchen scale?
No, we don't. I've gotten out of the business of reviewing cookware because I've done it for 25 years, and I think I've said about all I could possibly say about that. But maybe not. I don't know. But I mean, I can just tell you, you want a scale that can go back and forth between ounces and grams really easily. Some of them, I remember, have little things on the back you have to use a special knife to move, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to do that. It has to tear easily. And it's also nice that the display doesn't get covered up by the bowl. And most people don't know about tearing, T-A-R-I-N-G, which is simply you put a bowl on the digital scale, hit the tear button, which moves it back to zero in weight. You add your first ingredient, measure it, then hit the tear button. Again, it zeroes it out. So you can measure a series of ingredients all at the same time in the same bowl without dumping the bowl out. And it's a very efficient way of putting ingredients together.
Tim, thanks a lot for that question. Appreciate it. Don in Columbus, you're on the air with Christopher Kimball. Hi, Don.
Had several quick questions. For the cooking program that's on TV, I was curious what the background people are actually doing. Are they really making things or just there for sort of scenery? And the utensils, pots and pans, who cleans them? Are they brand new for every show? And if so, what happens to the old utensils and pots and pans?
Okay, some behind
excellent
the scenes questions. Yeah.
Well, this is the America's Test Kitchen show you're talking about. The first question is, are they really cooking? Yes. They are actually. The problem is when I was doing that show, we had to shut the kitchen down for 3 weeks. So we needed to have a place for people to continue to develop recipes. So they were actually developing recipes. That being said, if it was a long day, by 4:30 or 5, they may have run out of things to do. And so they'd be carving little tiny carrot butterflies in the background if you look closely. We did buy new, especially like Dutch ovens, like Le Creuset. We would buy new cookware for each season. I was actually against that. I kind of like the look of imperfect cookware.
Mm-hmm.
But all the film guys wanted to look good. So we do buy, or did buy when I was there, new cookware every season. Yeah.
Okay. Don, thanks a lot for that question. Thanks to Robert Miser in Columbus and Joel McClurg in Westerville for your support. We have about 25 or 26 minutes to go. Let's try to get 20 more pledges before the end of the hour. I'm sure we could do it. Because I said, we have Central Ohioans just two walls away taking those calls right now. 1-866-897-9678. That's how they show their support for 89.7 NPR News, by donating their time to take your calls. Show your support by giving them a call. Give them something to do. 1-866-897-9678, or go to WOSU.org. Chris, you devoted a couple pages to the issue of the skillets that they use that
carbon
you
steel.
Recognize,
yeah.
Right, the carbon steel. You advised to toss your nonstick skillet. And I was watching a chef cook the other day when I was out for dinner, and they were cooking with the types of pans you recommended, and I was intrigued by that. Now I want one, so tell us why they matter.
Oh, they're just wonderful. They're cheap. You can buy them for $20.
Yeah.
It's carbon steel pan. It's very similar to cast iron, except, of course, it's carbon steel and it's lighter. There are two things you need to know about it, though. When you first season it, you wash it out with some hot water with some little bit of soap to get the initial oil off. You heat it up, put a little bit of oil in the pan, rub the oil into the pan, let it cool. You do that a bunch of times and make sure the oil really starts to smoke before you take it off the heat. But here's the trick. I was cooking with Fuchsia Dunlop in London a year and a half ago. She has a wok, carbon steel wok, and she would pour a little cooking oil, use cooking oil in it, just before she cooked. And that's the secret. So every time you cook with carbon steel, heat up the pan with a little bit of oil. When it starts to smoke, take some paper towel and just rub it into the pan. And then you've sort of pre-seasoned it. And over time, you have this incredible nonstick pan. I do scrambled eggs in it two or three times a week, and they don't stick at all. And you don't have to worry about the nonstick surface coming off. You know, they always come off over time. It's all natural. It also is a nice heavy pan, so it conducts heat and holds heat well. So carbon steel pans are terrific, and that's why, you know, the restaurants use them. All restaurants use carbon steel pans.
By the way, you start with eggs and a recipe for scrambled eggs and olive oil, which I love. I can't wait. I just was checking that out the other day. Scrambled eggs is one of my favorite things to eat, morning, noon, and night.
This recipe was a game changer for me. A couple years ago, for some reason, I just dumped some olive oil in the pan, not butter, about a tablespoon for two eggs. I heated up, it got really hot, put the eggs in, and they just fluffed up. I mean, it was just amazing. And I got these incredible fluffy eggs in about 20 seconds. And so I thought that finally, after 35 years, I'd invented something. And then about 2 weeks later, I opened up a Bass cookbook, and it said two eggs, one tablespoon of oil. And it was like, there's nothing new. And what happens is the oil gets much hotter than butter, because butter has about 20% water. So the butter takes a while to heat up. So the oil gets hotter, and it takes the air in the eggs and puffs it right up. So you get this incredible scrambled egg. So olive oil is much better than butter.
It without browning it? Because I like my eggs unbrowned.
Nope.
I don't like that
just
burned.
Not brown.
Okay, wow. I can't wait to try that.
You know, it's 20 seconds for
two
eggs.
That's another thing. I cook them really slowly usually.
Yeah. Well, there is another method, the French method, which is you cook the eggs very slowly, low heat, double boiler, at least in the old days, and butter and cheese sometimes. And that's a very different style, but that's also delicious. Nothing wrong with that.
Thanks to Robert Finney and Pataskalo for your support. 19 calls to go this hour. I just randomly picked 20, so help me randomly make this work. We have about 22 minutes to go. 1-866-897-9678 to show your support for 89.7 NPR News and All Sides with Ann Fisher, and to show us that you care when we bring folks like Christopher Kimball on the show. We work hard to get folks like him on the show, and he's very generously donated his time to the show. So show your support. 1-866-897-9678. Joan in Ashland, you're on the air. Hi, Joan.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say a couple quick things. I'm totally with Christopher on the salted butter. And one of my favorite recipes, I think it was in Country Magazine, was the roasted pork shoulder on the grill for pulled pork. It's excellent. It's a winner every time.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a Carolina vinegar sauce with it, too, and some coleslaw. It's a great recipe. But I'm a fairly decent cook and just have really been enjoying some shrimp and grits at a restaurant in Central Ohio recently and thinking about attempting it, wondering if he has any tips for the novice on shrimp and grits.
Christopher.
I think we did this recipe in Cook's Country. I believe we did it in Cook's Country a couple years ago. Comes from South Carolina, of course. But it actually, the shrimp and grits was invented fairly, I think, not until the 1970s. Obviously, shrimp's been around and grits have been around, but shrimp and grits is a fairly new thing. But if you go online to Cook's Country, I think there's a shrimp and grits recipe there that's actually pretty good. So I would suggest you go there. But again, it's not a 100-year-old recipe. It's fairly modern, which is interesting.
Is there any tricks to cooking grits, or is it just follow the directions on the package kind of a thing?
No, it's like doing polenta. I mean, it's you do it slowly, stir it, you put in flavoring ingredients. It's not hard to do. But I think people just need to take their time. I mean, you can do a quick polenta, for example, mm-hmm. which is fine. But you spend a little more time with it and stir it. It's creamier and it's better. But grits are not hard. I mean, of course, in the North, no one knows what grits are. But
we're learning.
You're learning slowly. But I would also say in the North, we don't know what cornbread is because I've had so much cornbread in the North, which is full of sugar. And, of course, in the South, if you put sugar in your cornbread, you probably get thrown out of the kitchen. But anyway.
All right, Joan, thanks for that call. Thanks to Francis Nutzling and Powell for your support. 18 calls left to go. 19 minutes left, I think, 19 or 18 minutes left. So thanks, Francis, for that. If you have a question or comment for our very special guest, Christopher Kimball, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. The first soup I'm going to make when I get a chance to really start messing that book up is the Georgian chicken soup, which incorporates six large egg yolks. And I'm kind of intrigued by that. It looks like a sort of a creamy chicken soup, but it's not. It's very brothy. Is it the eggs that make it creamy looking?
Yeah, well, I looked at that when that recipe came in a long time ago. I just said, really? You know, I thought it would be really heavy and
yeah.
Well, gross, to be specific. It turns out the egg yolks, because there's a lot of lemon in it too, it's very bright, and it tastes brothy. It's not thick and creamy. And it's about 45 minutes on top of the stove. It's easy to make. I've made it 3 or 4 times. And it's just a wonderful recipe. But it's one of those recipes that tastes much better than it sounds, because you see the egg yolks in there and go, like, that sounds like very 19th century French. But it's very light and bright tasting.
Is it sort of is there a Greek influence there, or like the chicken and rice soup?
Well, there's the classic Greek soup.
Yeah.
That's with the first thing I thought of, the Greek, the lemon, the egg yolk lemon soup. It's similar. I don't know if it's, you know, some 200 years ago there was somebody went from Greece to Georgia or vice versa concept. But it's similar, but it's bright and it's refreshing. I mean, it's just a wonderful soup. So just don't tell anybody there are egg yolks in it, and you're fine.
Exactly, exactly. Lauren in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, yes. I'm just calling in more to ask or make a comment. You mentioned that part of a recipe is the culture and the context in where you're eating it. And it sounds like you have had a lot of experience in traveling and trying different kinds of food in their natural context, like in the culture where they're made. And I've had a little bit of that experience as well. And I was just wondering if you could share a story, like a favorite story of yours, where you had an experience with food, but it was more that cultural context that really made it special.
Sure, lots of them. I was in Morocco a few years ago. I drove down across the Atlas Mountains. It's about a 4-hour drive, which, by the way, you want to take some sort of medication because people drive at 85 miles an hour with big trucks on winding roads. But anyway, I got to this little town and stayed at a kasbah, which is an old house, essentially. And I met the chef, the guy there, the cook, and I asked him if he could show me how to make, you know, a tagine, which is, you know, typical. And I was just shocked by the way he made it. He didn't saute anything. He didn't brown anything. He put the onions in the oil at the bottom of the pot for 2 minutes, then added the chicken and the ginger and the spices, et cetera. And the spices were incredibly, because they were grown in a very dry environment, were incredibly flavorful and aromatic. I mean, totally different than anything I'd ever experienced. You know, the cumin and the ginger, et cetera. And then we had it later on, and I could taste every spice and every ingredient in the tagine. And for me, and there were beautiful gardens, and he got all his herbs from the garden, and obviously everything was local. And it was just a simple dish, but unlike the American version where everything kind of gets melded, you know, like a curry, right, where everything gets put together, every individual taste was still there at the end. And so there you are in this wonderful, you know, desert environment, and every single thing shows up in your mouth. And that really, for me, was the beginning of Milk Street, because I realized that that's the ideal, right? Yeah, instead of everything coming together into one flavor, like a beef stew or an American chicken soup, this is a case where everything kept its own individual character. And, you know, it's not an expensive dish to make. It's just, it was just perfect. And it really changed my mind about cooking, because that's a new ideal for me now.
How do you find the people to observe cooking? I mean, when you stayed at that Casbah, did you know you were going to watch him? Is that something you arranged in advance?
That was actually on a vacation, and that wasn't specifically a trip for Milk Street. That was before Milk Street.
Mm-hmm.
What we do now is we spend a lot of time, my editor, Jason Hirsch, who is actually the food editor of Associated Press for years, he does a lot of the travel. I do some of it too. A couple other people do it, and it's a lot of homework before you go. Talk to dozens of people, try to find out if you can get into people's homes to cook with them, which restaurants to go to. But we like to get into homes. We have to find people on the ground who speak the language, who are connected. I'm going to Taiwan soon, and we've been spending a lot of time on that. I'm going to Japan. I'm going to Senegal, hopefully with Pierre Cham, who's a well-known chef in the United States, who grew up in Senegal, you know, to cook with people at home. And that's really the secret, is you get on the ground and go to someone's home to cook, and you spend time there cooking and eating. And that's how you get the context. Because going to a restaurant sometimes is useful, but most of the time, that's, you know, it's restaurant food.
Right.
We were in Cape Town. My editor was in Cape Town recently, and made a Cape Malay curry, which is a sort of an amalgam of Arab influences and Indian influence and other cultures, and it's a very different kind of curry. And he went to someone's house and cooked curry for 3 hours, you know. And that's when you get the real experience and the real recipes we're after, not the things that are all dressed up for the restaurant.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and this is our fall membership drive, and your support pays for the programs that you listen to every day. Listener support is the foundation of our budget. If it was a part of a recipe, I'm not even sure what I would equate it with, but something very, very important to maybe the chicken and the chicken soup or the lemon and the lemon tart. Go to WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. Make a gift of $10 a month as a sustainer and get the book Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. In this book, you learn to make a Thai beef salad, a Japanese potato salad, and a Spanish garlic soup. It's amazing. It has amazing, beautiful pictures and a helpful index in the back, as all great cookbooks do. This book is brand new, and you can get it as a thank you gift right now. Support All Sides and get this great book for $10 a month. Go to WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. You've heard a few descriptions from my guest, Christopher Kimball, the author of Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. He wants to change the way you cook and the way you look at food. It has recipes that will change your life: bolder flavors, simpler food, easier techniques, quicker suppers, an authentic and better way to make hummus, warm and whipped, a central Mexican way to make guacamole, no garlic and no lime juice, plus 150 other bold, simple recipes inspired by the cooking of Thailand, South Africa, Japan, Sichuan, Mexico, Thailand, I guess I said Thailand once, Portugal, France, Morocco, and many others. Full color photos of every recipe, more than 340 pages. It's a cookbook you'll want to use every day, just like all the best cookbooks out there. For more than 25 years, Christopher Kimball has promised home cooks that his recipes would work. Now, with his team of cooks and editors at Milk Street, he promises that a new approach in the kitchen can elevate the quality of your cooking far beyond anything you thought possible. These recipes are more than just good recipes. They teach a simpler, bolder, healthier way to cook that will change your cooking forever. It's a beautiful book. It's a hardcover. $10 a month as a sustainer. Get the book Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. And as you know, we're only ever asking anybody to show your support at whatever level that you can call. We still have 18 callers left to go and 11 minutes left in this hour. So give us a call right now, 1-866-897-9678. If you can't afford $10 a month, then think about what you can afford and think about how that correlates with what you value. When it comes to listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher, 89.7 NPR News, and all the other programming that 89.7 NPR News brings to you. 1-866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. And please show your support right now. Tell us that this is something you value, having the likes of Christopher Kimball on for an entire hour. He's an important person. It's just been a treasure to have him on so far. We only have a few more minutes left with him. I'd rather spend it talking with him than asking you to show your support right now. 1-866-897-9678 or go online to WOSU.org. Chris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hi, how's it going?
Good.
Good.
I just recently started raising meat rabbits, and I was wondering if you had any good rabbit recipes and also any tips on how to get people to get over the cuteness of rabbits and just realize that they're food.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I rabbit hunt actually from October through early March in Vermont, and I cook a lot of rabbit. The second question, how to get people over it, I have no idea other than serve it to them because I think it's my favorite meat. The one thing you do need to know, and I'm sure you know this, is that the legs, the back legs, need to be braised slowly over time. But the back strap or the loin, whatever you want to call it, is just like a tenderloin and needs to be cooked very quickly. So if you're going to cook the back legs for an hour or whatever, braise them an hour and a half, that's fine, and then just put the tenderloin in at the last minute, the last 5 minutes to finish cooking. And by the way, a friend of mine I hunt with often makes slow cooker spaghetti sauce out of it. So that's probably not a good idea because that meat cooks all day and dries out. But I braise the legs, and then the tenderloin's very quick.
He says he's raising meat rabbits. Chris, do you know what that means? I mean, what's the difference?
Yeah. Well, you get, first of all, those rabbits are going to be bigger than a wild, brownie rabbit that we have in New England. They're larger. There's more meat on them, and they're sold obviously just for meat. But it's the wild rabbits that I would hunt or anybody else would hunt are relatively small, and the meat rabbit's going to be probably three times bigger in terms of how much meat it's going to produce.
So, what do you compare the taste of rabbit to?
Well, I would compare it to the chicken you get 100 years ago.
Okay.
You know, not that I'm that old, but I mean, if you ever had a really good chicken, like in some other part of the world, which is locally raised, it tastes like that. It's just got a lot of flavor to it versus chicken, supermarket chicken today, which has virtually no flavor.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from Kevin who asks, Chris, can you talk about your experience and opinion of pardon me if I'm mispronouncing this, sous vide,
right. Yeah. Yeah, we did a test of that recently. Sous vide is now simply a wand. It's just a column which you put into any pot, and it circulates the water and heats it to a preset temperature. So the concept is if you want to cook chicken breast to 165 internal, you'd set the temperature on the sous vide machine to 165, and then you put the meat in a Ziploc bag. It's usually vacuum sealed. And then you can walk away for 2 hours, and it will hold the meat at exactly that temperature, so you'll never overcook anything. So that's the good news. The good news is you won't overcook anything. It'll remain moist. And you can actually put a sauce in with the chicken or whatever you're cooking in the bag. We do that as well. The bad news is you don't get any browning on the exterior texture. So sometimes if you want to sous vide something, take it out when you're finished and then quickly saute it off in a skillet. But it's a good system. The question is, if you spend $150 on a sous vide, are you going to use it enough, or is it going to end up in the bottom of a drawer somewhere? So it's a little bit like a pressure cooker or like a slow cooker. It's one of those things that are great if you really use it, but the question is, 2 months from now, are you going to still be using it?
Okay. Thanks a lot, Kevin, for that email. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is listener supported, 89.7 NPR News. And joining us this morning, Christopher Kimball, with our thank you gifts for this hour, the book Milk Street, The New Home Cooking. Contribute $10 a month as a sustainer and get this book. Your $10 a month gift can be withdrawn from your checking account or charged to your credit card, or make a one-time gift of $120. Go to WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. We have just 5 minutes left to go make that call. In this cookbook, you find more than 125 bold, simple recipes adapted and tested for home cooks everywhere. And Christopher calls it the new home cooking. So learn a way new way to scrambled eggs. I can't wait to try that. Learn how to make 21st century desserts and find lots of detailed instructions and tips for how to succeed in making these recipes. Go to WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. We're running out of time, so do it now. It takes just a few minutes at the most. Christopher, how do you put a book like this together? I mean, you mentioned earlier that one of the recipes was kind of the recipe that started the book. One of the experiences you had kind of gave the idea for doing the book. But how do you then go forward and compile them? What do you do?
I bought a huge bottle of aspirin, Tylenol, actually, and bourbon. That helped. It was a huge project because you have to come up with a list of recipes. You have to develop the recipes, which is a very long process. We use about a dozen freelance recipe developers plus our own kitchen with about five people. The recipes have to come in. Some of them you give up on at some point. The other ones you have to do a lot of work on. Then you have to write the recipe, and you have to make sure you write it in a way where you explain all the things that can go wrong and make sure it's clear. Then you have to photograph the recipe. Put that together. You have to write about the recipe. You have to check the color. I have to say, Little Brown has been my publisher for over 20 years. And you know, I've found in book publishing, there are a few people who still really love books. You know,
uh-huh.
It's not just a business. Michael Sherbin, who's my editor at Little Brown, is fabulous. And these people love books. And you can tell by holding the book in
your
hand.
I'm doing that right now.
They spent a lot of money. They didn't skimp on the paper and the binding and the cover.
It's
kind of an unusual cutout.
It is.
It's a die-cut cover. And, you know, they love books, and they were immensely helpful in the design of the book and helping us. So it was a real collaboration. So I've always loved books. I remember being in, like, third grade, and there was book day, book fair. Remember, I don't know if your school had that, but the publishers would pull their kids' books out, and you know, you buy the books you liked. And I just love a book. And you know, what's interesting is almost all cookbooks are purchased on paper. About 3% of cookbooks are purchased digitally. It's one of the few categories where the old print on ink on paper model still works, because that's the best way to bring something into the kitchen. So and also you can follow a recipe in a book easier than on a tablet or whatever.
Oh my God, there's no question
about
that.
So it's a big project. Yeah. So
this is absolutely beautiful.
A lot of bourbon and aspirin later.
Yeah. It's the heaviest. I think it's the heaviest. It's a heavy book. It's just beautiful. It is the binding is incredibly well done. It's super thick. It's just beautiful. I can't wait to mess it up. Thanks to Sherry or Cher Mitchell for your support. Sherry writes, I recently moved to Columbus from Colorado. I listen to Ann's show every morning, and it has allowed me to find joy and new information. Thank you so much. This is listener-supported WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus and online at WOSU.org. A service of WOSU Public Media, 89.7 NPR News, global, local. Christopher Kimball, thank you so much for your support tonight. Today, I really appreciate your time.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I'm going to use that quote. It's the heaviest book I've ever held in my hand. I think that's just what a great review. I've got to use that myself when I review books.
No, the part
is heaviest book.
I can't wait to mess it up.
Can't
wait to use
too.
It. Thanks,
All
Christopher.
Right.
Thanks,
Take
you.
Care.
Thank you, Libby Stearns and Pickerington, for your support. Once again, this is listener supported 89.7 NPR News, and this is All Sides with Ann Fisher. thanks for listening today, and thanks for showing your support. If there's still time, and there's about 30 seconds left, 1-866-897-9678, or go online to WOSU.org. Again, that's 1-866-897-9678, or go online to WOSU.org. Thanks to Lester Barnhart in London for your support of 89.7 NPR News. We appreciate all the calls. We appreciate the emails today, and we appreciate more than ever your support. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.